This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
Applications are changing the way that the internet is evolving, right? And in particular, there's a certain paradox at the heart of this that I want to draw attention to. And so, I mean, let's get started at least thinking about this. And I had a lot of trouble thinking about how to structure such a lecture, so I encourage you to interrupt me as we've set the tone in terms of discussion. I'm more than happy to stop. And I think this is going to be an example where we'll, I think, probably have a lot to talk about. But the thing I struggled with is that there's a lot of examples of how applications are changing the way the internet's evolving. So the list I chose here were some that I've thought about, but I think equally there's probably others that you can identify, and I encourage you to contribute that if you have such an idea. So okay, let's go back to this slide from the first lecture. The internet is a global network of independently owned and operated networks using packet switching and TCP/IP. We've talked about all of these things now. Now I think you should have a crisp understanding of what all of these things mean, okay? But I think what we haven't answered is, besides what is the internet, what is the internet's purpose? Now, that's a surprisingly subtle question to answer, okay? There's a lot of answers you can give to that. The internet's purpose is to connect together people. But that wasn't its original purpose. The original purpose was to move data between distinct geographical locations, okay? So there's a variety of different things. Today, it enables social economic interactions across wide geographical distance, enables data transmission, that was closer to the original goal. But this is the one that I think is kind of interesting and maybe suggestive. It's maybe we should define the internet by sort of its position as a platform. The internet itself is not necessarily the thing that's enabling these interactions, nor is it necessarily the thing that's enabling this data transmission. What it's doing is it's serving as a platform that supports innovation to enable all these things, as well as a whole range of other applications that we use. So we spent an enormous amount of time in this class focusing our attention on the pipes of the internet, basically. What's the infrastructure that makes up the network, right? But what we haven't spent a lot of time on is, what do we actually use the network for? And I think that today we think of the internet as this all-encompassing entity that includes not only that infrastructure, but also all the stuff that runs on top of it. But for the purposes of our discussion, I think it'll be useful to distinguish that platform, the underlying infrastructure, and the TCP. Remember, this is our definition. The platform is this network using packet switching and TCP/IP. Really, what that platform has done is to enable a very, very rich heritage of innovation over the last 20, 25 years. Okay, and I guess the interesting tension is that on the one hand, you have this network that was driven, whose popularity has been driven by its ability to support innovation. We see the whole range of applications that we have because of the innovation on the network. And yet, what's happening is, because of that innovation, because of new services that are deployed, there's ever increasing demands placed on the network to change, and actually to become stratified in a way that potentially will stifle later innovation, okay? So just to hint at kind of the stuff we're going to talk about, we talked about voice over IP and telephone traffic. So you have this beautiful network that's very, very, at some level dumb, but because it's so dumb and so simple, can allow you to build just about any application on top that you want. And clever guys get together and use some of the protocols of the network to deliver audio inside of packets and actually do so surprisingly well. Well, what's the reaction to that? Okay, so one reaction is, excellent. This is what the network was for. The network was this open platform that enabled this beautiful innovation of telephony over data networks. But another reaction is, we were sort of spoiled by the success, and now we want the network to change to treat telephony traffic differently, or to treat video traffic differently, right? So each application that I'm going to talk about, I hope I'll try to clarify. Each of these applications has the feature that they both leverage the fact that there's innovation, that they leverage the fact that the network supports innovation, that it's an open platform, and at the same time, they sort of suggest that we should be, you know, stratifying the network, sort of changing its structure in a way that supports these applications better. And I think what we lose track of is every time we add in a feature to support a new application, you're changing the structure of the network in a way that effectively is, you know, altering it away from that underlying simplicity that gave rise to that innovation, right? It's hard, it's one of the hardest things in society is to know the opportunity cost of lost innovation. You'll never know what you missed because of the design choices that you made. And so I think it sort of falls to the public at large, the designers, you know, the economists, policymakers, all these people, all of us to be aware of what you sacrifice when you make changes. I mean, over-engineering the network is not a win-win situation. There's an opportunity cost to lost innovation. So I said, I misspoke earlier. It's not all the applications aren't going to reveal this tension, but all the applications do have the feature that either they took advantage of this or they're an example of sort of changes to the network mandated by the application. So here's the kind of list that I came up with, and we'll talk about as much as we get through. HTML is the web language. BitTorrent is a common peer-to-peer file sharing protocol. We'll talk a little bit about streaming media, although we did talk about voice over IP before, so I won't spend too much time on this. Video downloads will touch on the point that you raised about the economics of video and what it demands it's putting on capacity. Wireless services are a really interesting example. So this is like services you get on your cellular device. Electronic markets, and by this I don't really mean eBay. I mean more like stock market trading, electronic stock market trading. And finally, we're going to conclude by talking about search and information management. And this should come back to why is it that even in the absence of controlling video, as a content provider, I may wish to control access, okay? So, you know, in these examples, these are the things I want you to pay attention to. Where did the network's ability to support innovation help an application? And where do these applications start putting pressure on the network to change to support them better? Okay, those are the tensions. So let's start with HTML. And HTML, I think, really is probably the biggest success story of the internet's open architecture, but you know, bar none. It stands for hypertext markup language. So to parse this, it's best to first remove hypertext. Markup language is basically, refers in at least in computer science parlance to a translation device between some codes and a display of text to the user, text and potentially images as well. Okay, so the codes might say, you know, put a table here, put an image there, indent here, etc. Right? Hypertext means that the text itself is sort of sensitive in the sense that it's actually something the user can interact with, right? And when the user interacts with the text, any variety of things could happen. Might open up an image, display a message, open a form, these types of things. Now, the idea of hypertext markup language, the idea of such languages is not unique to when HTML was created. The idea of using markup languages is not unique. There's one very unique feature of HTML. And so, I'll show you the source of a web page in a second. So it is the language in which all web pages are written. I should be a little bit careful about this. Today's HTML bears very little relationship to what HTML looked like when it was first introduced. There's all kinds of additional protocols that are used together with HTML. But for our purposes, it's okay to think of it that way. So it was created in 1989 at CERN, which is the High Energy Physics Research Facility in Switzerland, by Tim Berners-Lee, who's now at MIT, runs the World Wide Web Consortium. And the goal was to, at that time, enable more efficient sharing of research documents. So you had a research document that cited another document here, a link to another one there. That's where you would use hypertext. You'd see that there's a link to another research document. The user clicks on that link, and it should take him to that document. Okay? What's amazing is, you know, looking back at it, this seems like such an obvious thing, but at that time, it was a real revolution. At that time, there were already tools by which, if you had documents on your computer, then you could link them together, okay? So there were things like databases. Databases are essentially allow you to do that. You could have a document, fields from that document that are entered into a database, and then use these fields to connect different documents together. And more generally, there was a initial markup language that could be used to sort of connect documents. The real innovation was allowing linking to documents across computer networks. That was the real innovation. So to be specific about it, this is the source of a web page. Let's see if I can make the... This is the source of a web page from my group at Stanford, where it's the web page for our colloquia, for our weekly seminar series. Now, this looks like a crazy thing, right? And you see a lot of different codes, things like table, tbody, td, br, etc. A lot of these codes actually were codes that were around before Tim Berners-Lee created HTML. Right? The codes were part of a markup language already that was used, as I said, to display, you know, display text in some formatted way to the user. What was unique was one thing. It's this, the slash, this open bracket A, href, HTTP, and then slash A here. Right? What does that mean? This means take the mailman list info page and add to it a hypertext link, which is this. And this link was not just another page on the same computer. This was a code that said, this is actually a page that resides on some other host in the internet, right? And this HTTP is the protocol to be used to talk to that host. So an integral part of this was the hypertext transfer protocol, right? And because of this little innovation, suddenly what you had is that instead of just relating documents together on a single computer, you had linking between documents across computers. And at that time, it was a complete revolution. I was actually lucky enough to be someone who was using the web in 1993, which isn't long after this was created, and it was remarkable. I mean, the very first time that I used it, you know, it was a very, very rough-edged thing. The interface, it was NCSA Mosaic. It was a very poor interface, very slow, very, very clunky, but it was amazing to me that I could click on a document at my computer at MIT, and there's a summer intern there in 93, and actually see something in California. I mean, it was unbelievable at that time, and I think now we take it for granted, obviously, but it was really, I think, a remarkable revolution. So the thing that's important is, you know, what made HTML possible? That's the real question we want to ask here. Not, okay, I mean, we're all familiar with the idea that the web is a beautiful thing and it's a great revolution. I don't think any of us would dispute that, but the question is, what made it possible? I mean, why did it work? The thing is that underneath HTML is the TCP platform. So when you initiate, you know, let's say you clicked on a link, an HTTP link, really what it does first is it opens a TCP connection, okay, to talk to the computer that is pointed to by that HTTP locator. And on top of that connection, right, what does TCP do? Remember, the TCP ensures reliable transmission of data packets between your computer and the guy you're talking to. It doesn't interpret what's inside the data packets, though. It just allows you to put whatever you want in there. So in particular, what HTML did was it loads the packets with code. Code that says, you know, when you initiate a, when you click on a link that's an HTTP link, there's a code called a GET that's sent across the TCP connection that says, fetch this page for me. The return is the page broken into packets and coded appropriately. And then your program, the program running on your computer that's on the other end of this TCP connection, accepts those packets, decodes them, and displays them as the page. So the beauty of TCP was that it made two computers that were sitting completely across the ends of the earth from each other appear as if they were sitting right next to each other. In fact, appear as if they were actually sort of effectively the same computer. Right? That you could talk, you could embed any language you wanted inside of TCP packets to allow two computers to talk to each other. And I think it was critical here that this was an open standard. You know, openly accepted standard that was used by multiple networks, every major network at that point. And so anyone could build software on top. Right? And so for that reason, it's often cited as a success story of the open internet. By open here, I'm sort of using open in the sense of open source software, which you may have heard as well. The idea was that it was a standard platform, and everybody knew how it worked. And anybody who wanted to could write software that used that standard platform. In fact, today, if I want to, I can write an application that uses TCP however I want. It loads the packets however I want, as long as I can also get that application to someone on the other end who's willing to use it. Right? So, I mean, this was the whole story of HTML. You know, they had to make sure that after this, of course, it had to take off. It had to be huge. But part of the reason that it could work is because every computer on the internet was using TCP. So if even a few people found it useful to be able to do this kind of thing, all they had to do was download the requisite client, and suddenly they could all talk to each other. They didn't need anything else. It wasn't like they needed any guarantees from the network, right? So this is really a success story of being able to build on top of TCP. And actually, you know, this success story, this idea that TCP/IP and the related protocols that form the network stack, that they are so open and so extensible, it's something that we take so much for granted that it's a very quick reaction to say, you know, let's ram some additional functionality down into those protocols to deal with the problems we have now. I don't mean to sound too subjective about this, but I do think that we do sometimes lose sight of the support for innovation that these protocols enabled. So we want, I think that needs to be a counterbalancing force to a sort of a desire to change the internals of the network. Okay, so here, let's talk about another example that's... Sorry, any comments or questions or anything like that? Yeah.
So is there pressure on, you know, video sharers or audio sharers to design, redesign the way they're transmitting?
Yeah, so actually...
those into more like data packets?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, when we did talk about voice over IP, and we'll come back to that in a second, it is very much the case that voice over IP traffic sort of doesn't, in its raw form, doesn't play nice with the rest of the internet, with TCP traffic. And we talked a little bit about the UDP versus TCP. So there was a lot of pressure. And indeed, most, you know, the expected trend is one of two things, that either that traffic will be treated differently, or that that traffic will use protocols that don't grab more than its fair share of available capacity on the path. But it's a tricky thing. I mean, we're talking about changes to protocols here where it's not clear exactly what happens when all these different protocols that are now quite different from the way TCP/IP initially worked will interact with each other. But we'll come back to that in a second, actually. BitTorrent, all the examples that we have will highlight a very similar tension as the one you just raised. So BitTorrent is a peer-to-peer file sharing. How many of you have used BitTorrent before? Okay. So at Stanford, BitTorrent is kind of the, well, at least has been for quite some time, the choice method of acquiring illegal content. In a sure sign of, you know, changes to the internet, these days, if Stanford's IT services catches you using a BitTorrent client, you'll get an email saying, we've noticed unusual activity on your PC that suggests you may be using a peer-to-peer client. And it's worth noting that uploading illegal material or copyrighted material is, uploading copyrighted material is illegal. You know, and so if this is not what you're doing, then your computer may have been compromised and you should check it out. And if this is what you're doing, then you should stop. Okay? That's very interesting, right? Because they can't inspect the packets directly to know. I mean, these are files that are broken up. It's hard for them to know, you know, what's going on. There's a signature to kind of where the traffic is going and the volume, let's say, of traffic, which is detectable to be able to conjecture that someone has peer-to-peer traffic. But they can't even send you an email that says, we know you were using BitTorrent.
Right? Is this not a port?
What's that?
Is it a particular TCP port?
For BitTorrent?
Yeah,
So it's in part it's port scanning that they're able to take advantage of. It's not port scanning, but I mean port monitoring to know. But it's also, there's a signature to BitTorrent traffic that's somewhat detectable. So I think that's interesting, right? From Stanford's point of view, they would love to have monitoring technology that just makes it obvious that you're using BitTorrent. Right? In fact, they would love if there was a flag in every packet that said this is a BitTorrent packet or this is a peer-to-peer file sharing packet. Okay? But we don't have that functionality in the internet right now. We should ask, is it functionality that we want? Essentially, what we're saying is, should we be tagging packets with the kind of content that they are? What would happen then? Well, what if there were sort of rigid highways along which different types of content can flow? I mean, what if there's treatment for voice over IP packets, file transfer packets, you know, business class traffic? That's different. I mean, this is one of the arguments that underlies network neutrality, if you've read about it. One of the complaints that people have is that where would HTML have come from in that environment? What would it have been tagged with? Right? It's this new traffic outside the normal classes. Maybe it's operating in some very narrow band of capacity that's not saved for, you know, that's out there for people who want to experiment. Would it ever have taken off in such an environment? Okay, so that's kind of if you go all the way down that road, you can get some rather extreme conclusions, I think, that you need to temper a little bit with sort of thinking through the technology. But all that said, I do think there's a clear issue here that detecting BitTorrent traffic is one example of sort of changing the network. So I do want to talk a little bit about how BitTorrent works, and in particular how it has an impact on routing. So the goal of BitTorrent specifically is rapid dissemination of files that are in high demand. So BitTorrent is a one-way peer-to-peer file sharing system. You start with someone who has the file, and his goal is to get it to lots of people quickly. Right? Good example is like very like popular movie trailer or something like that. Another good example is like the last episode of 24. All right? So, you know, if there's a movie show or a TV show that's really popular, not out on DVD yet, not on iTunes yet, or on iTunes and you don't want to pay for it, within an hour of 24 finishing, it's up on BitTorrent to download. Actually, with much higher quality, I might add, than you can get otherwise. But I mean, there's no way I would know that, of course. So, so how does BitTorrent work? You start with one person who has the file, okay, and that's called a seed, and it breaks that single file into chunks. So this is very stylized. I'm dropping a lot of details here, details that are quite pertinent to its operation. But for the point I want to make, this is sufficient. So it breaks the single file into chunks. And downloaders start acquiring chunks of that file. So the file might be multiple gigabytes, but it's broken into very, very small chunks, relatively speaking. And when you download, you actually just download a chunk at a time, right? When a chunk has been acquired, then you immediately turn around and start offering it for upload to others. And that's where it gets its speed. It doesn't wait for an individual to get the whole file before he passes it to someone else. So you can think of this, if you go back to our example of shipping a book cross-country, ripping the pages up and putting them in envelopes, imagine that now you want the book to go to 5,000 people. So you rip up the pages, and you just mail them to random people. And each of those people, as soon as they get the page, copy it and send it on. And what you'd like is that, you know, this random mixing of pages eventually gets everybody a copy of the book. Now, if everybody waited until they had the whole book, it would take really long. But there's no particular reason you have to wait. You can reassemble the pages later. All you care about is just get the pages out as fast as you can and get them in as fast as you can. So that's basically what BitTorrent does. It breaks these chunks up, and the key step is that you start uploading before you finished downloading the entire file, okay? So it starts uploading the chunk it just finished, starts downloading a new chunk, and just keeps going. Now, there's some interesting mechanisms in BitTorrent to decide who you upload to, who you download from, but I don't want to get into that. And you know, again, to emphasize, the key point is that you start uploading before you finish downloading. So here's the big thing, okay? If it's a really popular file, then at any point in time, there's going to be lots of places where you can get a chunk, right? So, you know, putting aside, BitTorrent tries to make sure that everybody's participating equally, and so that it rewards people who share a lot. But let's put that aside for a moment. Let's just suppose that I could get a chunk from New York, you know, Boston, Chicago, Dallas, all over the U.S. Right? There's maybe 10 locations all over the U.S. Well, what will BitTorrent do, all things being equal? It'll optimize the source that it picks to give me that chunk. What does optimize mean? BitTorrent's goal would be to get me the chunk from someone who sort of can deliver it to me the fastest, who has most available capacity. Again, I'm stylizing a bit, but the basic idea is you look at the performance, you try to get it from someone who can get it to you as fast as possible. But that's nothing but a routing decision. What was routing? Routing said, here's a file or a packet. Get it from point A to point B. Well, a slight abstraction from that says routing is there's some data located somewhere around the network. Get it from that point to me. Now, the fact that there's multiple copies of that data and I can get it from any of those points is sort of irrelevant. All I care is that I get a copy of that data. So deciding where to get that data from and the resulting path that the data takes is a routing decision. BitTorrent controls one of those two things. It controls which source it selects. Once it's picked the source, it doesn't control the path that the data takes. That's determined by the network. Remember, we talked about IP, how that works. And so the interesting thing is that network service providers, you know, they are the ones who control how distances are configured to choose routes, right? So that, you know, remember we have shortest routes, but the shortest routes are based on business policy and the distances that the metrics that network service providers choose. Well, from their perspective, they want to control routing. They want to control where traffic goes. Their goal is balance traffic across the network, make the network as easy to run as possible, limit the chances of failures because of congestion. But BitTorrent has its own ideas. Its goal is, I want to get the traffic from wherever I can get it fastest. Okay? And that sets up a natural game. So basically what's happening is, BitTorrent's optimization is creating a virtual network with routing decisions that are optimized by the BitTorrent clients, not by the network service provider. Okay? And this is what's called an overlay network, if you've ever heard the term overlay network. Overlay basically means, here's the internet. It's doing, you know, it's making routing decisions and guaranteeing reliable delivery using TCP. Let's put another network on top that also makes routing decisions and decides where traffic should go and potentially also guarantees reliable delivery, as BitTorrent does here. Reliable here means you get all the chunks, basically. So BitTorrent's responsible for making sure you get all the chunks. So because...
BitTorrent is just an application. It's not a central authority.
It's an application, yeah. So the central authority thing, let's be a bit careful, I guess. When you release a BitTorrent file, there's often what's called a tracker, which is centralized, which sort of keeps track of where there's availability of chunks to download. And that, you know, that is somewhat centralized, and one of the reasons why it can often be easy to shut down illegal sharing. On the other hand, BitTorrent's response has been, I don't know if you've seen the BitTorrent site recently, but they've legalized... they have sort of a legal service that they offer now. That hasn't led to any decrease in its use for legal file sharing, but it is a step in the right direction, or the wrong one, depending on where you stand. So peer-to-peer networks adapt their downloading decisions based on network performance. Okay, so BitTorrent is looking at the performance across the network, choosing the source that gives you the best performance. But then network service providers, they want to shape where traffic goes based on what they see inside their own network. So what do you see? You see one player optimizing where it's getting traffic from based on performance, and the other one optimizing where traffic goes based on its own perception of performance. Now, those two don't necessarily have the same idea of what good performance is. And so what this sets up is kind of a nested back and forth between the two. One optimizes, the other optimizes. One optimizes, the other optimizes. Right? These two don't always interact well. So I thought I had a comment about this here. So I want to go back to what we call the end-to-end principle, you know, when we talked about this in the second lecture. The end-to-end principle was, don't implement, I mean, if I roughly translate from what I said there, don't implement functionality twice. Put the functionality where you're sort of, where you're doing the least redundant work. And what's happening here is the internals of the network are optimizing where traffic is going, and so are the overlays, right? And that interaction, I think, is sort of an example of, you know, one of the pressures on the internet. I mean, one of the common discussions that goes on in academic circles these days, as well as industry circles at some level, is if everything starts moving on overlay networks, then why do we need any intelligence in the network at all? Why don't we just have these big bit pipes, as we talked about, that just push bits around, don't even make any decisions. Just let the overlay networks make all the decisions. And everybody can have their own protocol, and everybody can do whatever they want to do. Now, what's an argument against that? Why not effectively just partition the network into a collection of overlay networks with different applications?
Yeah. BitTorrent wouldn't have that granularity. I mean, the TCP goes through maybe 30 hops to get to some place. Would BitTorrent have all that?
Yeah, so you're right that BitTorrent isn't a protocol, but... And so maybe we keep TCP around and IP around, but maybe we have this very, very dumb network that we don't really change in any way, and allow all new applications to just be their own overlay. That's sort of the suggestion. And I mean, so what would be sort of an issue with the approach of just partitioning the world into overlays?
Yeah.
Yep. So that's a definite argument, is inefficiency. But let's suppose there was a lot of capacity too, so that you had local congestion every once in a while, but let's suppose on the whole maybe this would be okay. I would argue the biggest cost is, again, a lack of a support for innovation. If you have a network that's supporting innovation, then you don't want a partitioning of the world into a bunch of independent overlays. Because again, I mean, if you go back to this question, where would HTML come from? Would you have a new overlay set up for HTML? There's a penetration problem, right? How do you enter?
I don't see how this is partitioning. It seems like it's just another application. What do you mean by partitioning?
So one argument goes, and actually, let me go to the next slide on this. So one argument goes that you know, so enterprise networks that are distributed across large geographical space will buy network capacity and then just run the network however they want. You know, run the network over that capacity however they want. Akamai is another good example, which they don't actually own the capacity in the middle, but they, you know, they've contracted for it. They've contracted for how much they're going to push into the network. And then they do their own optimization of where traffic comes from. We saw some of this last lecture, right? So, you know, I think it's a sort of nebulous statement that I'm making deliberately. But the comment is, okay, well, each time an application comes along that's successful, let's just partition it off as an overlay, right? But that's a kind of, there's a very subtle misdirection of logic going on there. What had to happen for the application to be successful in the first place? Well, it had to take off somehow. It had to have an open platform to build on. And ultimately, that platform is kind of what some of these applications take advantage of, right? Now, I mean, Akamai, again, was, you know, I think an exception to that. But it is definitely true that things like BitTorrent, things like peer-to-peer file sharing that are considered overlays, really initially succeed because they have this open platform on which to play. So, sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just thinking it's like taking the freeway and have a bus lane, a carpool lane, a bicycle lane, and you can't go from one to the other? Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, so, I mean, I don't want to... Yeah, so the argument that he mentioned as well is akin to that, the efficiency argument. What I'm talking about more is I think, a slightly higher level and not necessarily technically well-defined, which is, if you have a new technology, right, that's taking advantage of the open architecture of the internet, how do you get people to play with it? Right? And the wireline internet has had this nice phenomenon that it has such an open architecture that if there's really something compelling out there, it's easy to get people to play with it, provided they want to. Once you start partitioning into overlays, see, so one question might be, for example, why can't I take advantage of Akamai's internet map? What if I have some clever way of delivering peer-to-peer video that takes advantage of what they have? But I can't do that. This is a closed network. Now, that's private, of course, but still, if they have a proprietary structure to their network, it's not something that I can, you know, actively participate in. So, yeah, let's move on from this. I don't want to dwell too much on the mapping to technical detail. I just, again, want to support this kind of high-level thought process. What does it take for a network to support innovation? Right? So I did have it there. I just didn't bring it up. Okay. Note how overlays relate to the end-to-end principle. All right. So let's go to streaming media. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because we talked about it a couple lectures ago. But we've seen that TCP is not an ideal solution when you care about delay instead of loss, right? And so that raised the question, how should the internet handle streaming media? We talked about voice over IP a little bit. Video on demand is very similar. The initial implementation of RealPlayer used UDP as well. And so it basically, you know, pushed, it didn't really care about lost packets, just pushed, pushed video packets into the network using UDP and hoped that most of them would make it to the other end. So, you know, thinking about how the internet should deal with this, one possibility that's been suggested is the internet should prioritize streaming traffic so it suffers less delay. Now, the problem with priorities is that in order to get priorities to work, there has to be a difference in pricing. Right? So the Paris Metro in the 1980s had this policy that, you know, all the train cars were identical, but one or two of the train cars were first-class cars. Now, if you just label them first-class cars and you charge the same, then it doesn't make any difference. So what they did was they charged a lot more if you wanted to be in the first class car. You didn't get a better seat. You didn't, you know, there's no amenities or anything like that. It was exactly the same car. They just charged more for it. And the point of charging more for it was that there were less people in the car. So, you know, you had a more enjoyable experience, right? Well, similarly here, just prioritizing traffic won't make any difference. If you just put a label on the traffic as high priority traffic, well, everyone will call their traffic high priority traffic. The only way you can prioritize is if the priority is attached to treating that traffic differently at a monetary level. Right? Either that or regulatory. You have to say there's a regulation that you can't tag all traffic as streaming. Well, you know, because the internet's privatized, it's deregulated, that regulation is really going to be monetary. And now we are talking about charging different traffic differently, right? Charging streaming traffic differently from regular data traffic. And that's, again, going down this road of partitioning into different traffic classes. It's not a bad thing necessarily. Maybe this is what the internet needs to support streaming traffic as a fundamental part of the architecture. What do you lose when you do that? Again, any sort of move towards partitioning potentially down the road has the opportunity cost of a compression of support for innovation for the same reasons we've already seen. You know, and we've already talked about this. How can you guarantee that UDP does not eat up available capacity? So I won't dwell on that anymore. And this is really the thing. You know, so we talked about how this essentially suggests a move to charging. But then when you have those traffic identification schemes, you can do a lot more. If you have the identification scheme available to prioritize, you can do a lot more with that scheme. Now, I mean, maybe you just not only charge streaming traffic differently, that's maybe tautological that that's going to happen, but beyond that, maybe you charge different types of streaming traffic from different providers differently. When it's Time Warner Cable's streaming traffic, then you treat it just fine. But when it's Google's streaming traffic, you treat it differently, right? That's where the net neutrality argument picks up steam, is that once you introduce differentiation mechanisms into the network, they can enable things that they can have unintended consequences in the way the traffic moves. Now on to video. So this is kind of I think it's a really fun topic these days. Oh, yeah.
Do you think it's correct to say that without doing something like prioritizing packets, you won't be able to get it to work reliably?
Well, it's a good question. Again, it gets back to this issue of over-engineering versus provisioning, right? So Skype works very well. And one of the reasons Skype works well is there's a lot of network capacity provisioned already. It has, so just for hard numbers, a standard voice call in the old telephone network required 64 kilobits a second. And you can actually get decent quality with 32 kilobits a second. And in fact, as Bell Labs moved forward, they had developed coding schemes that could get it down to 16 kilobits a second, which is actually quite small. 16 kilobits a second is like, you know, 2 kilobytes a second. So it's very, very little. One of the reasons why Skype works so well is because you have so much capacity that maybe there just isn't that much delay most of the time, right? So as video increases, let's forecast out and the network gets really congested, you'll see a problem. And you have to ask yourself at that point, what's the solution to the problem? Do you treat telephony traffic differently? Do you provision the network differently? There's a cost to both. And I think that cost calculation is something that's very hard to do. There's a provisioning cost, but there's an opportunity cost as well, and we need to understand what the end game of that is. So I also think, I keep harping on the opportunity cost of making changes to the network. I actually think there's also opportunity cost to not making changes to the network. You sort of, the whole ballgame here is to know how you can extend network functionality to meet evolving needs while sort of containing, you know, the opportunity cost of innovation as much as possible. Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's
I should have had you give this lecture actually, because the next example is wireless services. But yeah.
Well, I didn't mean to preempt, but I guess what I'm saying is that if people want it and they can just a simple person go, well, I know it's bigger and it's more interactive and it's,
yep,
you know, it's a video as opposed to I'll pay more.
So yep.
I guess video is the only thing I've ever seen that, to my mind, an ISP could charge for. Differently than just text, right?
Well, I think
sort of data or application on the internet.
Yep.
Video is one that
So I think the thing you have to be careful about is, and we've seen reasons why this was an issue before as well, is to equate capacity and value. Equate the bits that are pushed with value. I think the issue is, so think of it the following way. Suppose that the network becomes congested because of video, right? Even if the network is charging for it. Right then, you need to make a credit card payment on let's say, a loan or a car or something like that, right? It's a small transaction, but you really want to get it through. And so the equation of quantity and value is something that's very problematic from that perspective. So I think that's the real way that they can charge is by determining when someone has a high-value transaction they want to make, regardless of its size. Now, if there's no congestion in the network, they really can't charge for anything on that basis, because anybody can get anything through whenever they want. These things only start to hit when there's a possibility of either lack of reliability or congestion that can cause problems for something that's mission critical from an individual standpoint or a company standpoint. So that's how I would think about the value. We're going to talk a little bit about value and cost next week when I wrap up the course. That's kind of one of the big things I want to conclude with. But I think that, again, we've talked about that earlier, that value equals quantity is a very hard equation to draw. Oh, so I see it's 8:15. Actually, I'll tell you what, why don't we pause here? Let's take like a 5-minute break. We'll come back and talk about video and wireless after that. So let's see, you'd asked me a question. I said that I would get the answer to this. Do you remember what it was? And was at least, I think he means on a per participant basis, the most voluminous exchange in the world. YouTube had 20 gigabits of peering traffic on its own in February 2006, right? So what does peering traffic mean? It means YouTube had peering connections at multiple locations with other providers and other networks. And this was the traffic that it sent out across those peering connections. This is to say nothing of traffic that it was sending out across transit connections as well. And that amount, the number came from something like 50 million views a day. I think there's a rough mismatch here, but nevertheless, it's sort of the right order. And this is in 2006. It's been, it was expanding at an enormous rate. So a reasonable forecast would be that a video provider like YouTube in another, let's say, 5 years or something, would be serving 200 gigabits per second of video, per month or something like that. I mean, notice when it says 20 gigabits per second in a month, you should be careful. This measurement is actually that 95th percentile measurement. It's not 20 gigabits per second continuously over the month. Okay, but anyway, still 200 gigabits per second in the 95th percentile there. That means you even take out the top 36 hours of traffic in that month, you're still left with a massive amount of traffic. Looking ahead a few years. I said down here, there's not enough backbone capacity to support many such competitors. If you get YouTube expanding by a factor of 10, there's not enough backbone capacity to support one YouTube. Okay, so that's a serious problem. So when I say not enough backbone capacity, what I mean is, if YouTube said, I want a 200 gigabit per second connection to the internet, that is not possible. It's not something they can buy. Okay, so it's not that there isn't enough network capacity across the entire US and the world to move that much traffic around. The problem is there's not any way to get one connection from YouTube in one location to the rest of the internet that serves out 200 gigabits per second of traffic. Right? So that raises the question then, how should video be distributed? That's kind of a good thought experiment. This guy, Bill Norton at Equinix, I put a website address up here, pch.net, that has all kinds of interesting resources to learn about this stuff. Equinix is another company that has some interesting white papers, and so I'll put up a link to that as well on the website. I'll put both of these up there. A third company, by the way, is Renesas, that has some interesting information. That's where I found out about the Cogent deep peering. So all three of those, if you're interested in this kind of economics, it's an interesting thing to read about. So let's look at what Bill Norton says. Bill Norton's job is, Equinix runs a lot of internet exchanges. Bill Norton tries to stay on top of what tier one ISPs forecast as being major trends in the network industry. Right? He's a very interesting guy to talk to. And what he did was he put together a white paper where he said, okay, what are the different ways that someone who's thinking about getting into the video service industry could provide the video? Right? Well, one possibility is you put all the video you've got on a single data center, and you buy transit, and you serve the video out from that data center. Okay? And as I just said, no one has enough capacity to do that for you. Extrapolating out to the 200 gigabits per second, let's say, there's no way anyone can give you that. And even if they could give you that, it would be too expensive. I guess those go hand in hand, right? One way they could give it to you is to build out a massive fiber deployment just for you. That would be too expensive. But what he meant by too expensive is, even if you just build at current rates per megabit per second, it would be too expensive. Yeah?
Does that mean there's just one data center, one server?
Yes. What I'm suggesting here is you just install the data center at your... Yeah, exactly. And then buy this massive connection to the internet. Let somebody else handle routing it around. Okay. All right. Well, that seems like not such a great solution. So another solution is to purchase a content delivery service like Akamai. All right, so now you just upload to Akamai's servers, Akamai takes care of distributing it for you. But Akamai sees themselves as providing a value-added service. They're improving service to the consumer. They actually charge more than transit prices for their service, as well they should. If they don't charge more than transit prices, there's not really a money-making opportunity there. So then that's really expensive as well. It turns out that this is like on the order of several million dollars a month if you're, you know, if you're actually thinking about using Akamai or buying transit, right? Which is an enormous, enormous amount for just network service. I mean, remember, he's thinking here of a, you know, relatively sort of small-scale video provider in the sense of how many videos they're serving, but high demand, right? Flash crowds for the videos, like lots of popularity. So if you're that type of video provider, you know, several million dollars a month startup cost is a lot. I mean, even YouTube doesn't make any money despite the $1.6 billion acquisition, they don't actually make money on their video service. So starting up, you know, it's a hard thing to pay for. And so one thing, the last thing you got to was, what about a peer-to-peer video distribution method? So you take the video, and you just upload it a few times to people around the internet, and then you let them trade among themselves. You have clients that you control that manage intellectual property rights, and the clients basically are BitTorrent clients, but coded to make sure that, you know, everything is legal and legally downloaded. Well, this turns out to be very cheap. You just upload it a few times. It's hard. It's sort of. It turns out to be two orders of magnitude cheaper than doing it any of the other two ways. And if it's that much cheaper, the question is, who suffers? Or does anybody suffer? Why not just do it this way? And furthermore, if you believe that somebody will suffer, then when is peer-to-peer video distribution a good model? Right? So before I do anything else, let me just ask, what do you think about this? So again, just to be clear, the video guy, you know, the video server, you know, he has, let's say, a new movie trailer or something that he wants to get out there. Actually, that's a bad example. Let's say that he's got, you know, a sort of independent film that's been produced. And the film is not going to go through standard distribution mechanisms. He just wants to get it out there across his server on the internet, no release to theater. And so what he's going to do, you know, has three options here. He can just buy a massive link and just let people download the video from him. He can contract out to Akamai, upload the video to Akamai's servers, and let Akamai take care of getting it to people. Or he can upload it a few times to people around the internet and allow them to use peer-to-peer transmission to get it from each other rather than from him. Yeah. Oh, sorry, do you have a...
I was just going to say, I mean, Akamai seems like a good bet to buy stock in, right? I mean, they're well positioned. I mean...
I don't know.
I mean, that was the thing that just came up.
I don't think so, actually. I mean, sorry. I make no comments on stock picks, but as far as...
Forgetting that, there. Yeah.
So they look like they're in a good position, but they're getting. You have to remember that Akamai's business model is delivering neither content nor network service. They're delivering optimization of network service. So the problem is, what if a content provider that's big decides to buy their own, let's say, sub-network and optimize service across that network, as Google tries to do? What if a content provider buys access, right? Then you have a content provider with a large backbone and an access network, a large number of eyeballs. It can optimize transmission without needing somebody like Akamai. What if a video provider uses peer-to-peer? It circumvents what Akamai is there to do. So I think the most important thing is Akamai is leveraging a very particular economic niche created by the way that internet contracting and economics work today at the infrastructure level. But if that changes, it's a fragile position to be in. They neither have content nor do they have really the network service. So.
I just to address the question that you raised about
usability,
that if I were kind of distribute a movie.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, and it kind of relates to the example you gave about what happens when you build out a big infrastructure and everyone goes broke. Well, it may be occurring now with video where you have all this investment going into it. I mean, YouTube, Google is suffering a big loss.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, I'm trying to distribute a movie trailer. Why not just upload it on YouTube? There's no advertisements. Suffering all the costs. What I'm curious about is what happens when they do need to attach a model to it, which they're in the process of doing.
Like
putting in ads, then maybe you don't want the ads, and then maybe the peer-to-peer model.
Yeah, you raise a good point, actually. So one thing I'm assuming here is that the video distributor wants direct to the consumer access, doesn't want to go through a third party. You're right that in today's business model, there's plenty of free avenues by which you can get videos out there, and someone else handles the traffic volume for you, that maybe you don't want to be the one to do it, and YouTube is a great example of that. I think that, let me at least wait to see what other answers to this question are, and then my answer to this question is going to be related to what an answer to the question that you just raised would be as well. Yeah. Yeah.
Does Google's purchase of DoubleClick have anything to tie in with this? Doesn't DoubleClick provide...
So I think DoubleClick, at least the main business that Google's getting out of DoubleClick is advertising tracking. I mean, Google's, you know, I think primary business model at this point involves a combination of advertising and content, and coupling advertising to the content that consumers view. And DoubleClick is great because it allows them to track what content consumers care about. And if they can track that across multiple services, video as well as, you know, text searches and so on, then it's a very powerful mechanism. But not so much on the video front. I mean, as far as I know, DoubleClick doesn't really have... You think about advertising.
Or about serving things up.
Yeah, the thing is the scale here. The problem is that the scale of video is completely, I mean, it's several orders of magnitude more than anything else that you can think of, along the lines of what you said. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, who suffers? For cable modem, I mean, this BitTorrent is turning it upside down, because normally you download more than you upload, but this you would upload more than you download. That's a technical statement, but I don't know
what's the implication, right? So the naive reaction to this is that somehow the local ISP suffers. Because what's happening now is it gets downloaded once, let's say, to my home, and then I upload it to all my neighbors. So that means I'm using up all this capacity on uploading to all my neighbors, right?
Well, around the world you're uploading.
Yeah. So let's start with my neighbors.
Yeah, okay.
The thing is, whether my neighbors got it from me or from somewhere else, it has to travel across the line to their home anyway. So in reality, the network, the local ISP doesn't suffer if all I do is upload it to my neighbors. When they suffer is what you said. They suffer if I get it and then I upload it to people that are across the country. Because now it's passing up through my ISP across a link that they're paying a transit cost for. Right? And as the more traffic goes across that link, that's something they don't want. Right? So that's what local ISPs don't want. What's interesting about this debate is local ISPs are dead set against peer-to-peer video distribution. They complain about two things. One is that it's very hard to track the rights. And so what they'd like is a share of the revenue that's collected when peer-to-peer video distribution is used. And the other thing that they're worried about is this transit cost problem. But there seems to be a decent solution for everyone. You use peer-to-peer video distribution, but just restrict peer transmission in local areas. Right? So as I said, you know, video needs to move to customers anyway. So it's going to eventually have to move down that link to your home. If it comes from a local peer instead, then there's less load placed on the backbone, which in a sort of efficiency sense is a good thing. It's probably not something backbone providers want to hear. But one possible problem is if the video doesn't come from a local peer, then there is an additional network cost incurred that the video provider didn't have to pay for. Right? So as long as peer-to-peer video distribution is allowing transmissions across a wider radius than just the absolute local neighborhood that you're in, then it is definitely true that what's happening is that this video provider can take its hands off and say, that's not my problem, somebody else should pay for that. Right? Ultimately, the consumer will pay because the access provider will raise prices to the consumer to cover that cost. And so there's, you know, either the consumer or it'll charge the content provider. In the current climate, it seems more likely to be the consumer than the content provider. So, you know, the implication from this thing is that this example is that, you know, the way that the way that video distribution takes place, because of the size, because of the magnitude, really has the potential to completely alter economics of interactions between content, network, and user. Right? Again, there's a value problem here. So when the video provider uploads the video to one user, and he, let's say, I mean, in the extreme case, what could happen is the content provider just sends one upload to some guy in a cable network, and that guy uploads it to the rest of the world. Right? In that situation, all the cost of uploading that video has been completely offloaded onto this user, you know, somewhere else in the internet. Right? And the reason the ISP doesn't have to pay for that is because there's no value transmission that's sort of accounting for the flow of those packets back to this content provider. And furthermore, the reason that he can actually do it, the reason that he can implement such a thing, is that the internet has an open platform. You know, if I wanted to, so Juiced is an example of this, the company Juiced that I believe Viacom acquired. If they want to, they can write a client. And was it Viacom? Is that right? Do you know?
I think it's still independent.
It's still. So that's what I meant. They had a deal with Viacom. I'm assuming that's going to go through. It's a natural competitive balance against Google's acquisition of YouTube. So if they decide to provide a client that enables this peer-to-peer file sharing mechanism, there's not anything anyone can really do to stop them. The internet's fundamental protocols support this kind of extensible creation of new applications. So what's the reaction to this? Well, clearly we don't want ISPs to be left in the cold where they're suddenly, you know, forced to support massive amounts of additional uploading of video inside their own network that initially should have been coming from somewhere else. Economically, that doesn't seem to make sense. But if you start to think through charging mechanisms that prevent this from happening, there's significant changes to the internet that would be required to enable those mechanisms. And those changes, again, are changes that start a stream of events in motion that can dramatically alter the way the traffic is classified and moved around the network. Okay? So we keep seeing recurring themes here. You know, you have a support for an innovation that enables all kinds of new services that we never had before. And those services then push up against economics and then force us to re-examine the protocols and potentially lead us down the path of implementing changes to protocols that then, you know, are preventing us from supporting future innovation. Okay, so one aside, and in the interest of time, I'm not actually going to spend time discussing this right now. I'm happy to return to it next time if we want. A question for discussion: should a video provider stream video to consumers, or should he upload video to consumers' PCs before playing? Very interesting debate here. Right? So it's analogous to saying, you know, so you get DVDs in the mail. Is it better to get DVDs in the mail, or is it better to be able to just on-demand watch it on the television? Right? Now, that is not quite a good comparison, because you pay in different ways for each of those things. Usually when you buy on-demand, you buy per movie. When you have a subscription for the DVDs, you pay a monthly rate. In addition, the experience is quite different. The delay on DVD is quite different from the delay on-demand delivery on your cable connection. But if you're talking about streaming versus uploading, suppose you have fiber connections everywhere. How long will it take to upload a 4 GB movie? How long will it take to buffer enough to stream that video? In fact, you could argue, is there even really a difference between these two things as the network gets fast? Right? I think it's an interesting question. I think it's one you should think about. By the way, does everybody understand what I'm saying here? If there's any confusion, let me know. But what I mean is, either you could sort of watch it online and the video is being served continuously from somewhere else, so it's real-time video, or the video is first downloaded and then you watch it. Notice the difference between like iTunes and RealPlayer here. Very different modes of video distribution. Okay, let's stop with this one. This is, I think, a great, great example of what the modern internet has become. So we talk about network neutrality a lot, and if you read about network neutrality, then I'm not sure, but I would guess that wireless service providers come up very rarely explicitly in that discussion. Okay? Typically, the discussion is about content providers and the guys who own, you know, access to homes. And yet, let's look at wireless providers, guys like Verizon and Singular. Well, they control the applications you use on your cellular phone, right? Now, if you want, you can unlock your phone, and that's good because it lets you use someone else's chip. But typically, if you really want to leverage their networks, you have to use the applications they gave you on your phone. You get a little bit of flexibility. You can download various things, and there's you know, ringtones and games and so on, but it's all stuff that's controlled, typically, by the service provider. Now, they don't manufacture the devices, but they have a lot of control over the device features you get. I have a Motorola Razr. I'm sure some of you may have a Motorola Razr. My Motorola Razr is a Singular Motorola Razr. So it has certain device features enabled. Like if I click on the World Wide Web button on that, it brings up Singular's browser. Other guys that have a Motorola Razr, you know, maybe have the Verizon version that actually has an MP3 player built in, is connected to Verizon's music service. So they actually control an interface between the device and the services, the applications that they have. And now let's move down from there. Singular is owned by who? AT&T. AT&T is just merged with SBC, controls a lot of access to the internet. They also control, I should say, a backbone, not the backbone. Right? So what do you have? You have the perfectly vertically integrated company here. You have someone who controls your experience from the device to the application to the network. It's the best they could possibly hope for. Right? The only thing they don't control is if you decide to talk to someone who's not on your network. And we know there's an enormous push by providers to get you to talk to people on your network. Right? There's major incentives to do so, as well as the plans are structured so that you have much better control over features when you do talk to someone on the same network. Right? These days, the kinds of data plans that you can get have far, far better benefits if you're talking to someone else on the same network. Right? I think that's interesting. Because if you compare it to support for innovation in the wired internet, this is an example of a closed, controlled platform. And so, we were talking about earlier, what did I really mean by like partitioned overlay networks and so on? I think maybe it's easier to explain kind of the theme I was trying to bring out by contrast with this. If you contrast the current internet with wireless services, the distinction is remarkable. So let me ask you, if you ask someone, how many consumer internet startups are there? A consumer internet startup is someone who started a company that delivers a service over the web, and hundreds, thousands, right? How many startups are there that deliver services on wireless devices? What's that? Even that is, I think, a real overestimate. And I think you may be right about dozens, let's say, but the question is really, what's their business model? What's their plan for penetration? It's to be acquired by a wireless service provider, right? I mean, a lot of internet startups want to be acquired as well, but their plan for penetration is typically not, let me get acquired and then everybody will use my service. It's let me get everyone to use my service and then I'll get acquired. Right? Very interesting, that difference. So, not surprisingly, also, wireless service revenues are much higher, right? You pay a lot for data services on a wireless device. And it's amazing because you're paying for data services that are basically controlled by the service provider. Now, there's a shift going on here. If you buy a wireless device now, then you can use the wireless device as a modem with your laptop, for example, at reasonably high speeds. It's called 3G cellular networks. So you buy a new device from Singular that's a 3G device, you actually get reasonably high data rates if you use it as a modem with your laptop. You can just be sitting in the airport, open up your laptop. As long as your phone is on, you can use it to send and receive from the internet. One thing I've always wondered about this is, suppose that people started making voice over IP calls on that network. The reason that it seems nonsensical is because you pay for unlimited voice calls on your cellular plan anyway. And it's very, very hard, and I would say impossible, to buy a cellular device with an unlimited data plan where you can use the thing as a modem without buying a voice line. You can't do it. All right? It's remarkable. It's brilliant, too. It's the exact thing that the guys who own telephone networks would love to do. They would love to be able to say, fine, you can buy DSL, but you have to buy the phone line, too. Right? But it's just hard for them to do that. They'd be leaving business on the table. Cellular providers, no problem. They've got people locked in to being able to buy, to buying voice and the data services. I don't know what the future holds there. It's not clear what the competitive pressures are. It's not clear whether there's enough competitive pressure that if one guy branches out and says, I'll sell a data plan without the voice plan and has a fast enough network, that suddenly you might see a shift in the way that the economics work. I would argue that first, that's a possibility, but second, you would expect to see saturation in the quality of the data service if voice over IP was used by a lot of people consistently. So I think there will always be, they inherently have the benefit of the fact that the wireless medium does not have as much capacity as fiber optic cable. That it's inherently significantly lower capacity than fiber optic cable. You just can't ship as many bits through the air as you can through fiber. Interference is the typical problem that you see. I mean, we all know what interference sounds like, but it's a problem for data as well. And that allows them to create congestion a lot faster than you can on fiber optics. The commodity that they're dealing with, by being able to package and sell the good in this way, they're able to make much better use of the available capacity than free use would. So it's very interesting, the evolution here. I think that we're all so worried about the network neutrality argument on the wireline internet. And all the while, right under our noses, is this incredibly vertically integrated service model. And if you ask people, you know, then you read like, you know, sort of technology magazine reviews of technologies that are going to affect you over the next 50 years, wireless and mobility are at the top of the list. You know, having everything hooked into the internet, having wireless devices moving all over the place, constant ubiquitous connectivity. So we think of it as the biggest technological revolution in the way we interact with the network, and yet we're completely oblivious to this trend, which is against what sort of the, you know, which seems to run counter to what the network neutrality debate is centered on. So yeah.
Do you think that might relate where you have some visionaries who say, you know, if it was structured in such a way where we could enable innovation on one hand, but there's not kind of this popular realization of the opportunity cost of innovation that's being missed to kind of mobilize people to.
So you're asking, you know, why do we find ourselves in this situation? You know, I think the real problem, I mean, I thought a lot about it, and I mean, even, you know, I consider myself someone who's kind of working in this space, but I often feel ignorant when I think about that question, because it's very, very hard to evaluate what the opportunity cost of innovation is. I mean, when I think of opening this up, you know, I'm not sure what the right approach to that would be. You know, one example is that Nokia is trying to create a device that basically speaks every wireless protocol that there is and runs on Linux. And they think they can get buy-in from service providers to sell this device to consumers, in which case you would suddenly have an open platform on which people could develop anything they wanted. It seems to me that's not likely to happen. But it also seems to me it would be really nice if it could happen. I just don't know, you know, given past history, I don't know what the economics are that line up with the technology. And that's, when I say I feel ignorant, what I mean is, I think it's a hard question to evaluate the opportunity cost of innovation against the benefit to society of an economically sustainable infrastructure, you know? I mean, even despite such a closed platform, it's clear that we've all been the beneficiaries of a tremendous revolution in wireless data and voice services. So what did we miss? You know, we don't know what we missed. But we know something happened. And it's that trade-off. It's a very hard evaluation to do. So I'm not giving you an answer, really. I guess all I'm saying is I don't know what the right approach to that is.
I guess maybe it opens the possibility. I guess one other broader question is, do you think it's possible that we could find ourselves down such a path where, with the internet as it is, it becomes more closed to the point where we can't easily make changes?
Yeah, that I think is quite possible, absolutely. So you see what the effects of vertical integration can be. And so actually, we're out of time. So let me just forecast a little bit what we're going to talk about next time. We just talked about this. So I'll talk about electronic markets. But the last thing I'm going to talk about next time is search. And search and information services are very interesting, because you'd like to think of the internet as this very broad network with access to a whole range of different content. But there's a real concentration of where we get our content, right? I mean, everybody's searches flow through Google, for example. Where do we get video? Majority of video comes from YouTube, CNN, New York Times, right? If you list where the majority of content is, what most people are looking at, it's concentrated in a very, very few locations. It's a lot like broadcast television or cable television. So there's a lot of power in the control of those high visibility application services. And the more visible they are, the more visible they stay. That is, there's concentration that happens. I mean, the more, you know, hits that you get, the higher ranked you become effectively, and the more visible you become. So that you're sort of self-sustaining at the top of that hierarchy. And the further down at the bottom you are, the harder it is to get discovered and realized, you know. As long as we have mechanisms that can discover and pull sort of new content to the top, we don't risk stratification, I think. But I do think there's a chance down the road with ownership of applications, access networks, and backbone networks, top to bottom, that suggests that maybe there's no particular reason for a consumer anymore to need to go outside the network of the guy that he's subscribed to, right? Like AOL is a good example. I mean, maybe we see the rebirth of something like AOL, where, yeah, I want video, but all the video I want, AT&T has. Maybe I want to make phone calls, but everybody I want to talk to is on the AT&T network. And maybe I want to, you know, search for information, but all the information I want is contained in information sites that are available through AT&T. And you know, we think of it as being sort of ridiculous because we have access to everything now. There's no constraints. But is it really that ridiculous? I mean, think about what you look at during the day and imagine how little effort it would take for concentration in where that content comes from, you know? So I think that's an interesting piece of food for thought. We should come back to that next time. But I think the question that you raise is a very, very good one. Are we down that path? I think that we should be aware of what the consequences of that kind of application and network concentration are. I don't know that we're so far down the path that we can't be aware of it and then make economic decisions that are sound, but I think that barring any other action, it's the natural evolution of where things have been headed recently anyway.
The preceding program was brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U and is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of the Leland Stanford Junior University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.